Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning. I'm your NBN host, Lavinia Stan, a professor of political science at St. Francis Xavier University in Canada. I am talking today with Luke Moffat, a professor of human rights and international humanitarian law in the School of Law of Queen's University in Belfast, and a fellow of the Senator George J. Mitchell Institute for Global Peace, Security, and Justice at the same university. Welcome to New Books Network, Luke.
Hi, Lavinia. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for accepting this interview about your recent book, Reparations and War, Finding Balance in Repairing the Past, which was published with the reputed Oxford University Press earlier this year. Before we start our interview, our discussion about the book, Luke, can you tell the listeners something about your background?
Yeah, so I'm from Northern Ireland and I grew up towards the end of the Troubles, and it was quite a, it wasn't the worst violence part of the Troubles, most violent part, but it was growing up in a place where you regularly were used to a lot of military presence, a lot of bombs going off, people being killed. So it was normal, so it was, to have that sort of violence going on in the background of growing up. And you never really thought differently. It wasn't a war as we'd understand it under international humanitarian law, because it wasn't that intense. It was more of a low-intensity conflict. But even though the peace process came in 1998, there was still, you know, bubbling over of violence, which comes and goes at times. And nobody in my direct family was killed, but I know with other family members, there was about four or five killed during the Troubles, and one killed that before during the Civil War. So it has an impact, I say, you know, over time on how people deal with trauma. You know, some people just ignore it, some people talk about it, and some people try to engage with, you know, civil society or different groups or even the state in order to try to get some sort of help. And it has repercussions on our society. It has repercussions on communities and families, I've seen it ruin so many people's lives, both for themselves, their children, even their grandchildren. And you know, part of my background of getting into law was to make a difference, to, you know, sort of pursue some sort of justice. But I, you know, sat in the courtroom and I got bored really quickly. Maybe it was, you know, it was a magistrate's court dealing with quite, you know, mundane issues. But I started doing law as my undergraduate, I wasn't really thinking about, you know, becoming a barrister. Then it was sort of off put. I thought I'd work for an NGO or civil society, and so I did my master's in human rights law. I did both at Queen's in Belfast, because it was our main university, and it also has a really good history of doing human rights during conflict. It was set up in 1990, but, you know, people like Kevin Boyle, Tom Haddon, Bryce Dixon were all very much involved in conflicts in Kurdistan, the Middle East, Central Africa. So it was really good learning from those experts during my undergraduate and postgraduate. But the PhD I never really thought about doing. And my PhD was all focused on the ICC. And so when I finished it and published my first book, I wanted to sort of get away from talking about the International Criminal Court, because it has a tendency of sucking all the oxygen out of the room in relation to how we think about dealing with mass atrocities. You know, in issues around Ukraine, Gaza, Sudan, people go, well, you know, that's involved in the International Criminal Court. And, you know, from doing my research, which is mostly desk-based, but I also did some field work in Uganda, I found that it was more idealism than actually practical reality, particularly for those who were, you know, mostly affected. And so over the past, well over a decade now, I've been working with some local victims groups in Northern Ireland, but also around the world, on issues around, you know, access to justice and reparations. It definitely has shown the gap between the international norms we have in human rights law or international humanitarian law and the reality of victims struggling to get any sort of recognition and redress. So I worked with an injured victims group in Northern Ireland, was associated with Wave Trauma, and had people who were injured in their 20s, in the early 70s, and were left to live in poverty, and they were discriminated against. They had very physical trauma, but also, you know, I'd know how mentally they would exist every day. No one, you know, they had to live with us and live without being able to get a job. It was just, you know, they were very strong people. And, you know, I came along saying, you know, let's talk about this issue of reparations. And they sort of rejected it out of hand. They said, you know, we don't want anything to do with the Treaty of Versailles. You know, we don't think it's all that useful. But, you know, we built a good relationship. You know, I became part of their efforts to push for reparations. And, you know, they didn't need me to articulate, you know, what their needs were or what they wanted. They were firmly of the view and knew how to deal with, you know, very difficult political and media interviews, as well as, you know, sort of mobilize people. So it was a real learning curve working with them. And in the end, in 2020, the law was passed, and they now will can apply for a pension. And that's what they wanted. It was a way of getting their financial security. And so in the background of all this, you know, post-PhD, I wanted to do more work on reparations. It's something which I find interesting in my PhD, but also wanted to sort of broaden my understanding. So I got more involved in transitional justice. And I was lucky enough after my PhD to go straight into a job with Kieran McAvoy and Louise Malander and Gordon Anthony in the School of Law at Queen's. And they were looking at how to apply their research in amnesties and prosecutions to policy debates in Northern Ireland. And that was well over a decade ago now, and we're still having those debates. So it's very frustrating how slow things come. But also it's how the state resists any sort of interrogation of its role, but also the role of paramilitaries in our society, which now some have transitioned to political groups or, you know, community workers, which is good in terms of peace building. It's not great in terms of actually dealing with the past and dealing with victims' needs. So there's about over 2,000 unsolved murders, people who were compensated for bereavement, for those who family members who were killed got next to nothing. And we've only really resolved the issue with injured victims. So working on that postdoc was a really good way of, you know, mixing doing research and also policy engagement. I think part of our ethos at the School of Law at Queen's is always about giving back, that we're privileged enough to do this sort of research. But we also work quite closely with local groups, whether that's worth, you know, with the elderly, whether with children in the criminal justice system or whoever. It's always about building that sort of connections. And we're sort of lucky that we're a very small place that we're able to do that. But in a long way of getting to, you know, how I got to sort of this book was I applied for a number of grants and I failed to get a lot of grants. And then I sort of went for just applying for a big grant. And we took about 18 months to write it. And I was able to bring, you know, Kieran McAvoy, Clara Sandoval, Peter Dixon, James Gallen, and my good colleague at the School of Law, Cheryl Lawler, on board in the project. And we were lucky enough to get funding. And we started the project in 2017. And it's, having never done a large project before, we were overly ambitious. We promised a lot. And so then the problem of having to deliver, you know, we had 12 policy reports. We had like a whole range of things we had to deliver. And also we said we'd do interviews in 6 countries. So we did a lot of traveling before COVID, you know, working with different NGOs and victims groups in Guatemala.
May I ask which countries were included?
Yeah, so
which are the 6 countries?
Yeah, so we went to Colombia, Guatemala, Peru, Nepal, Northern Ireland, and Uganda. And we also had a little side project in South Sudan, and we've done a little subsequent work in Ukraine. So really the whole point of the project was to interrogate to what extent are reparations implemented in societies moving away from conflict. As Lavinia, you probably well know, is that a lot of the research that was written in the early days of transitional justice was on authoritarianism, stuff that you've written extensively on in Eastern Europe, but also in Latin America, and even you'd say about apartheid as well in South Africa. But the transitional justice, there hasn't been a good systematic review of how things work post-conflict. And so the peace-building studies would do a lot around that, but transitional justice wouldn't really. So in relation to reparations, we wanted to look at that, in particular the role of victims, the role of civil society, and also non-state armed groups, to what contribution they can make.
So my next question would have been, when and how did you discover your passion for transitional justice? But it is by now clear to our listeners that your personal background is where your passion for, and indeed this passion is palpable in a way, in the way you speak, in the way you relate about your postdoc and about your previous project. I just wanted to remind the listeners that Reparations and War is not your first book to make an impact in the field of transitional justice. In 2014, you published Justice for Victims Before the International Criminal Court in a Routledge series on research in international law. And you told us a little bit about that project. And 3 years later, you were the co-editor of the research handbook on transitional justice, with the second edition being published in August this year. Does the new book on reparations in any way builds on these 2 previous projects? I contributed to the research handbook, and I was very pleased to do so. It's a monumental contribution to the field. It's one of the most respected reference books in the field. But do you see a continuation of all these huge projects leading up your recently published book on reparations?
Yeah, that's kind of you say those words about the books. I think it is a sort of a trajectory. You know, my first book on the International Criminal Court came from my PhD thesis, and then we were lucky, Cheryl and I, to get involved, and then we took over the editorship of the first handbook with Dov Jacobs, and there were some really good contributions, including yourself, that were already there and ready to go. So we just sort of pushed things on, and then having the most recent edition coming out, it's been really good, just sort of read and bring together such a great cohort of people who are working on this quite difficult area. And sometimes I feel that I get a bit jaded about transitional justice, because you know you struggle for so long and some things don't change and other things get republished, maybe with a different title, in terms of like sometimes the articles just re-engage with stuff that's already been brought forward, and then you come across an article which sort of reinvigorates the field. And so I think the book itself on reparations and war was trying to broaden the gaze beyond just transitional justice. It's very heavily, you know, looks at transitional justice. Those 6 countries were all going under some sort of transition, and transitional justice is the sort of byword of how to deal with these mass atrocities. But I also wanted to sort of think about, you know, what place does transitional justice law and even us as like academics and civil society play in shaping these debates. And so I wanted this book to sort of be the best thing I've ever written and to really reflect on the state of the field and how people actually experience law and justice. And so like we were very lucky to interview well over 300 people in about 166 interviews. And we had some like excellent like interviewees. We spoke to like judges who were in the Maoists in Nepal. We had judges in Guatemala who had, you know, it sat in the very big cases, but also had attempts against their life, and even lawyers in Colombia, who talked about, you know, I was like, you know, why do you do this risky work? You know, your members of your team are killed, and they were like, this is the most dignified way to practice the law. And so it's those sort of things that would sort of rebuild your hope in humanity, and maybe even in the law a little bit.
And in law and lawyers.
Yeah. Yeah, because we also always have this bad image of lawyers. But I think that, you know, working with victims makes it more real, because this is their daily existence. And I think that if we tolerate what happens with them, you know, our children are sort of next sort of mentality, that we, like, when victims, you talked about, you know, with reparations, one of the things isn't just always about money, it's they don't want this to happen to their children or grandchildren. This, you know, guarantees a non-recurrence. So the book itself was trying to tie all these different threads together, especially because it's quite fragmented when you look at reparations. There's a lot written in international law, there's a lot written in transitional justice and human rights law. So I was trying to pull it all together, and also think that none of this stuff is new. You know, that historically reparations have been used for perhaps thousands of years. So it's maybe something about the human condition. How do we sort of end violence in a way?
So let's start by reminding listeners how the first case of reparations dating 1928 set out a guiding principle for reparations. What was that? Have reparations evolved since then?
Yeah, so the sort of the big origin story of reparations in international law comes from the Germany v. Poland case, Chorizo Factory. It's not all that exciting case. It's about, you know, disputed ownership after the First World War. But it sets down this really important principle that international law still abides by. So the International Court of Justice, the ICC, different countries around the world. And in that case, it says that, you know, reparations should, as far as possible, wipe out the consequences caused by an illegal act. And sets down a few other principles as well. But in that sort of notion, is reparations being practiced to some extent as a measure of justice. But what I talk about in the book is that this ideal version of reparations is wiping out the consequences of wrongdoing is impossible. You look at contemporary conflicts, you can't, you know, undo those who've been killed. You can't remedy those who've been seriously maimed in conflict or suffered torture or sexual violence. So then it brings back then, what are we trying to do with reparations? And I think one of the biggest things in the book was that reparations are obviously for victims, to help victims, but for perpetrators, for those who are responsible, reparations are an important mechanism for taking ownership of the wrongdoing and try to not repackage it, but a way of sort of saying that we engage with normal values of the rule of law and that we recognize wrongdoing and we want to remedy the consequences that we have caused. So it's about them taking ownership of their wrongdoing, really.
Just it occurred to me now that somebody might say reparations, in fact, translate human suffering and human loss in money, and this is wrong. This is not teaching the perpetrators that much, and it might not help victims that much. How would you respond to such a view?
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate criticism of reparations that you're paying for blood money, you're paying for violators to continue to violate. It's a way of sort of a way to them to pay off victims and to silence them. But I think where we see it for reparations now, particularly in human rights law, is that money isn't just enough for gross violations. You really need to also have acknowledgement, you need memorialization, you need investigations, and importantly, you need a guarantee of non-recurrence that those responsible won't commit it again. The thing is, sometimes money is the only thing people listen to. So you think about corporations operating in conflict areas. You know, a family member who would work in this area of dealing with complicit actors would always say, you hit them in their pocket. And that's how you get them to comply. So when it comes to the state is a legal fiction. It's something we create as an entity. And so in some cases, we can prosecute individuals, and that's separate from reparations. It's linked, but separate. But, you know, the state then has to take responsibility in changing its behavior. With armed groups as well, it's something we dealt with extensively. And it's something that they want to deal with because it shows them that they can be like the state, or they can be responsible actors.
Your introduction starts with a simple truth. And you say here, I'm citing, reparations cannot cure the harm caused by war. You continue by stating that it may seem strange to start a book of reparations and war in what it cannot do. Why this as a starting point?
Yeah, I suppose it may reflect some of my frustration that I would be involved in a lot of events at high level, also of NGOs and different international actors. And they would always talk about, you know, we need to, you know, seize the assets of this person. We need to prosecute this person. And by giving reparations, we'll help victims. And really, reparations used in a rhetorical way like that are like a band-aid over a massive wound. Like reparations are very politically contentious. And or something which are quite technical as well. So when you start really getting into the detail of it, it's quite problematic. So because then it's, you know, you'll know this well, but, you know, dealing with issues of vetting and illustration, who gets involved. So I wanted people to have an informed account. I'm not trying to manage expectations, but I think when people say reparations, people think money, oh, victims are going to get paid off here, or that it's going to cost the government too much. I think that we need to have a well-informed discussion about reparations when we start using that word.
I agree. Can we tell the listeners something about the main structure of the book? How does the argument unfold?
Yeah, so I originally wanted to write 6 chapters, and I probably would have wanted to write 10 if I had the space, but the book set up in 9 chapters, and really the introduction gives a good starting point because in the introduction I sort of pull upon some of the questions we asked our interviewees. So we asked 300 people. The first question was always, what does reparation mean to you? And we got this kaleidoscopic view of different terms that were associated with reparation. Some people said money, some talked about dignified repair, some used local terms, which when translated didn't really match to what reparation was. So the book sort of talks about the vernacular of reparations, how reparations as its own form of language has its own power dynamics. And that's quite problematic then in terms of how then victims can access their rights. So the first 2 chapters are quite theoretical. The first chapter sort of sets out the ground for how reparations have previously been discussed. And so there's a lot written on reparations and dealing with a whole range of issues from colonialism, you know, the transatlantic slave trade, to also then conflict and, you know, authoritarian regimes. So there's quite a lot of theorizing about how best to deal with reparations. So I wanted to sort of capture that debate because all those different strands in that first chapter, so justice, morality, and sort of reconciliation as justifications for reparations. I used some of that in the second chapter to sort of come up with my own theory that reparations aren't really about trying to reconcile with your enemy or to recognize victims' harm or to ensure justice of the perpetrator. It's more about trying to find a balance between all these competing things. And also importantly, trying to look at it from a social legal approach. So there's a lot of things we use in law, particularly notions of proportionality or feasibility, which is actually in that that judgment of Chorzow Factory, where it talks about reparations should as far as possible. So it's not trying to say that reparations are unlimited or something which is minimal, but aims to strive for the maximum. And so reparations is balanced. It's about trying to get these competing interests of victims, trying to get as much as possible to deal with their harm, as they rightly should, but also the capacity of the responsible actor, the state or the armed group, to provide that. And so the middle point is that, you know, that that axis so much, trying to push reparations forward. And it's something which changes over time. So I talk about that a lot. So try to develop a new theory of thinking of reparations there. The third chapter is like the historical development of reparations. And so about 18 months ago, I was losing my mind trying to read everything I could on reparations and trying to go as far back as possible. I'm not a historian by training, but I was trying to go and dig up as much as possible. And so I sort of condensed it down into thinking about how reparations operated, not just in a sort of a Western perspective, but around the world, in different civilizations. And there was this consistent sort of practice of trying to mediate war and trying to end war by helping those who had suffered. Of course, reparations historically, in modern times, let's say from like the 1800s onwards, were used to punish those who were vanquished, to defeat the loser. And so the Romans used a similar sort of principle as well. So there's something to be said about empire and the use of reparations to punish those who lose conflicts. And that sort of plays through in terms of then also, decolonization after the 50s. So it's the second chapter. I actually really enjoyed writing it because there's a lot of stuff I learned and didn't know before. And we didn't really touch up on it in the reparations project because we were looking at contemporary conflicts. But the third chapter on that historical perspective tries to pull different threads together. And it also, it's an inconsistent practice. We can't say there's sort of clear rules. Even in the last 100 years, the fourth chapter talks about reparations in international law, and the historical perspective has been that states will often waive, so will not claim their rights to reparations, even if they've won the war or suffered a lot of victims, in order to ensure peace. So the fourth chapter sort of then looks at then the legal structure of that and how it exists today, and sort of pulls together sort of four main areas of war that are touched upon in international law. So the use of force, so the legality of going to war, international humanitarian law and the conduct of hostilities, international human rights law, where most of these things have been developed, and then a general reflection on international law in general and war. I think, where would we think reparations would be strongly when we think about war would be on the laws of war, on IHL, but actually it's very, very weak. And so human rights law has been used to sort of fill the gaps. But even there, human rights law gives way to the rules of armed conflict, because under the laws of armed conflict, you can target a site which is being used, such as by like a rebel or terrorist organization. And even if civilians are killed, provided it isn't excessive, it's still lawful. And so what that means for those victims is they don't have a right under, IHL, laws of war, to make a claim for reparations, because there's been no wrongdoing. There's nobody responsible. And that's fundamentally problematic then, because we see it in contemporary conflicts where you've got children being brought to hospitals, bodies have been digged out of buildings, that these people have died. And so legality sort of, wallpapers over these people's experience of suffering and makes the law quite hegemonic, that it's a way of those in power to use violence and not be held to account for it. So the fourth chapter sort of talks about, fundamental problems in international law in claiming reparations. The next sort of four chapters, which are more the chapters which reflect on the fieldwork. So the first chapter is about, victims and victimhood and how victims sort of claim reparations. And so it reflects on how we understand who's a victim sort of concepts which are currently still developing when we think about, the issue of environmental harm, how indigenous people have the relationship with land, and also sort of how even members of the army, so state forces, also try to feel themselves as victims or resist that sort of that label, as well as something which I've written a lot before about complex victims, so people who are also responsible for victimizing others. So we interviewed a number of child soldiers, a number of commanders who were involved in committing violations against other people, but also had suffered, terrible losses to their own family and themselves. So trying to reflect on, that sort of complex experience of conflict, because when people's experience of war is that it's not just one day, it's sometimes years, it's often decades living in a situation of insecurity. And so people can have multiple harms, And so one of the things to try to reflect on that final part of the chapter is, you know, about how harm, it becomes normalized. And that was like our experience in Northern Ireland. It was a low level conflict, but, you know, it's the everyday experience of, you know, being evacuated from a building before it's being blown up, or, you know, hearing on the news that somebody had been shot and he didn't know it was your family member or not, or even a shooting happened outside your school. So these were just sort of everyday things which people just saw as normal. And that's really problematic, but it's a way of sort of coping with this pervasive violence. So then how do we deal with that in post-conflict? It's quite complex because, you know, we interviewed a police officer and he said that, you know, they would have 30 to 50 incidents where per year where they saw, you know, a colleague being killed or shot or them having to go to a scene that was like incredibly traumatic. And instead of them going and claiming something, they would go back to their desk, open a bottle of vodka and just drink it, because that was the way, that was the culture of, you know, just sucking it up and bottling it away. So that sort of chapter reflects that sort of complex experience of violence. This chapter six is more about how reparations are administered. And so we interviewed a lot of people who were bureaucrats effectively in reparations programs, people who were responsible for delivering reparations and designing them. And it sounds really, really boring, but in actually in practice, it's a really important part of critiquing and thinking about how reparations work, because there was different sort of practices. You know, something which I probably would like to have done more on, but is this issue of how, you know, compensation and reparations are used by state actors, even, you know, some armed groups to pay off victims. So, you know, some people have written about how compensation is a weapon system and a strategy. It's a way of winning hearts and minds. And that's problematic because it just, you know, it greases the wheels of war. It just facilitates killing. And also, you know, something which was quite strong in places like Colombia and even in Uganda is where you have different perspectives within the state. The state isn't just unified. So, you know, you had a government brought in which was quite resistant to dealing with the past, but you then had people in different institutions who were resisting the state and trying to put through judgments or awards to victims, which went against the state's sort of you know, narrative of the conflict or its own ideology. So trying to reflect on that. And also that as human beings, we've got, you know, a very short amount of time on this planet, but also our memories are quite short. And so trying to reflect that, you know, when it comes to reparations, it's not something which happens overnight. It's something which takes years or decades to succeed. And, you know, I've sat down with a number of victims groups and told them this, and it's very difficult sometimes to accept, because, you know, they can't wait. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book, particularly in chapter 8, is about, you know, how harm worsens over time. And so victims can't just wait in reparations. So chapter 6 is all about, you know, the role of the state, and the state isn't always neutral or a sort of a peacemaker. It has its own agenda. And we see in places like in Guatemala, where we interviewed a government minister. We went to a famous case, Plan de Sanchez, before the Inter-American Court. And the court there had awarded quite extensive collective reparations. So collective in the sense that they would help the community, rebuild the roads, sewage works, a health clinic. And so we spoke to the government minister saying, you know, we visited this place and a lot of things weren't completed. You know, you're ordered by the court to do this, and, you know, judges regularly came to see about compliance. And we said, you know, one of the things is the road. It's a real dusty, you know, bad road going up this mountainside. And he was like, well, it's going to cost us like $1.5 million to rebuild this road, and the victims don't even want to help us rebuild it. So it's like, it was very, you know, broken understanding of what their obligation was. They were ordered to do this. They couldn't just say, we don't have the money, or, you know, we don't have cooperation. They, as the state, had to provide these things. So it was also trying to reflect that a lot of people who are put in these positions of these organizations were political appointees. And we actually were interviewing people who 2-3 days later were then replaced. So it's the high changeover and the lack of sort of memory that these institutions have as well. We expect them to know all these things, and sometimes they don't. So the chapter six, it's something I didn't intend to write, but it became quite interesting, quite important part when going through all the data of our interviews. Chapter seven was on non-state armed groups. And so part of our reparations project was to sort of interrogate and look at the role of rebel organizations or terrorists, however you want to call them, how they sort of dealt with reparations, because there was very little written on this like 5-6 years ago. A lot of people said it's either quite symbolic or it doesn't happen. And we interviewed about 18 different armed groups, and we found that there was a whole range of practice. What often happened was they often made, during conflict, reparations to their own community, because something happens, they had a, you know, they had a shooting with the army and some civilians got injured because of the way in which the rebels were shooting. And so they would go to the families and try to, you know, pay back, so, you know, buy a car or something, or, you know, replace something which had been damaged. And when it came to like injuring or killing a family member, they would either try and transfer the injured person to like medical facilities or give their own medical care, or pay, give some sort of money. Post-conflict, then that changes again. So how armed groups are political agents, and the sort of the difficult engagement they have to go through between, you know, being fighters, fighting against the state, fighting against their enemies, to then also recognizing their enemies as victims. And so it's quite a, you know, difficult process, something which is quite visible in Colombia, but is less so in places like Nepal and Uganda and Northern Ireland. So I talked through a lot of those issues, but like a lot of things in the book, they're also complemented by our policy outputs that we have on our reparations website, which go into more detail of like how armed groups actually deal with reparations, how civil society and donors support reparations. So it's quite a condensed version down. It's like, less than 35 pages on that subject. Chapter 8, which is the last final substantive chapter, is about what happens to victims who don't get reparations. So Olson and others nearly a decade ago looked at how transitional societies deal with a whole range of things, you know, truth commissions, prosecutions, you know, vetting and reparations. And when it came to reparations, they found that out of 84 sites they looked at, only 10 countries had, you know, partially, mostly, or totally complied in delivering some sort of reparations to victims. And so we found that this was the case in a lot of the sites we looked at. In the case of Guatemala, about, you know, 60-70% of victims actually benefited from the reparations program before it was finally stopped at ground to hunt. It was, you know, it stopped being funded by the government a couple of years ago. And so from talking to these victims, we were like, you know, how do you deal with this ongoing trauma and harm? And so in a way, it's about, you know, them mobilizing in their community. So some victims of the Rio Negro massacre in Guatemala talked about how when they started claiming reparations, they didn't go to the government first. They started with their family and community. And they talked about breaking down the walls of silence and even impunity there, and talking about, we need to claim this. We need to claim what happened to us was wrong, and, you know, seek justice and reparations, because otherwise it'll happen again. And for some of those victims, they got repercussions. Their family members, you know, left them, or chucked them out of their house. In one case, a victim, she was very adamant about testifying in a trial against the president, suffered domestic abuse from her husband, and her community also attacked her house because they thought the army was going to return and kill them all. So there's almost this self restraint that's within victimized communities, because they don't want to go through it again. You know, it's about survival rather than seeking justice. And so it takes victims that time to come together to mobilize. Also, it's to think about who speaks for victims. Some people have a tendency of making a job out of it, or you know, and there's a criticism in transitional justice of being an industry based around the suffering of victims. And so who speaks for victims is very telling about positions of privilege that is often, you know, urban, well-off, educated people, rather than what actually happens in conflict is, you know, people who are from you know, working class, or unemployed, even rural communities, which are affected most, and their voices are sort of left out of these debates. And so that chapter looks at then how do victims sort of come together, and really it sort of comes to the conclusion that reparations only succeed with victims. You know, we see that with the Germans Forced Labour Claims Commission that was set up in the early 2000s, with the reparations program set in Colombia. Those are two big reparations programs. The German Forced Labour Claims, like, it was over 10 billion dollars. That's because victims came together and put pressure on German companies and the German states to deliver reparations. The same with the Colombian reparations program. It was something that started in Medellin and then pushed to the national level. And it was because of the inadequacy of the previous, you know, provisions that were made, mainly, you know, the 2005 Justice and Peace Law, which didn't really deal with, you know, victims of state violence and guerrilla violence. So a lot of what comes about of reparations is because victims push for it. There is situations where reparations do occur because they're created by an international mechanism or by the state itself trying to, you know, satisfy international donors. So the example would be Sri Lanka, and the Office of Reparations was set up, or in relation to efforts which are currently going on for like places like Ukraine, where and even in Myanmar, where I suppose there's focused more investigation or prosecution takes priority, and victims have very little involvement in the design of actually, you know, what a reparations body should look like. And this is, it goes back to the sort of fundamental tenant in transitional justice, that any sort of effort to seeking, you know, sustainable peace and ensuring justice have to come from within the country itself. And that was the first report by Louis Jonet, I think in the 90s, when he started looking at this issue of impunity. And it's a self-evident truth when you're talking to people, because you can't impose justice or reparations from above. It has to, you know, actually mean something to victims. And so that chapter really reflects on that. It also reflects on that, you know, waiting all this time, victims find their own way of dealing with some of their harm, not all of it, because it's too big for them to carry, but how they sort of deal with this notion of self-repair. So we spoke to a number of Afro-Colombian communities in like Cali, and they would talk about, you know, the first place of claiming reparations is for them to come together and think about repairing and forgiving themselves. There's a lot of stigma around around, you know, victimization, and that you need to deal with that first before claiming redress. Also, the way in which NGOs and civil society sort of operate, that they provide important counseling services or memorialization, even like investigations to help support victims' claims. And so I sort of want to reflect on that notion of like informal and self-repair as a sort of a story of victims being resilient and having their own agency. They're not always waiting on the state. And so, you know, from working with the injured victims in Northern Ireland, they would always say that, you know, the state treats us like beggars. They're constantly forcing us to go up, and we're out in the streets, we're out getting petitions, we're going to the courts. You know, we are agents, you know, we're constantly pushing forward. We're not the little people, we're people trying to, you know, demand what's, you know, rightfully ours. So I think that was part of that last chapter, that story. And then the final chapter, chapter 9, is trying to reflect on all this. So about 40 pages looking at, you know, how does reparations work in practice, what the impact is. And so I was lucky enough to interview people who had received reparations. So some of the people who had suffered massacres in Guatemala, but also some of the families of Bloody Sunday. And that was a process in the case of Bloody Sunday, where you had British soldiers who shot dead 14 civilians who were part of a peaceful protest. They said at the time the IRA was involved, this Republican paramilitary group. And it took, you know, 40 years for the truth to come out in a big public inquiry. And then during our project between 2018, even up to today, there's still ongoing compensation cases. So at the time, the families were only compensated a couple of £100, so very little amount. And so more recently, they've got tens of thousands of pounds. In one case, somebody got £625,000 because of their income and their family members and stuff. So we were able to interview some of those victims before they got that money and then after. And it was just interesting, their perspectives. Some of it was quite... It was quite Northern Irish. We're not limited to how we swear. So it's but it reflects the sort of the emotions, and that money didn't change things for them. It was just part of that recognition. But even though they got, you know, in some cases quite substantive amounts of compensation, it was too little, too late, or it was undermined by the state resisting prosecuting the soldiers who were responsible. They were still shielding these people who had murdered civilians on the street, 50 years on. So it just reflects that broader problem. So that's the extent of the book. That's probably the most I've ever talked about it in terms of how it's structured, but it gives a sense of the different elements that are therein.
This is a wonderful book that provides a wealth of data on all these facets of reparations of war. If you were to change anything to the book, what would that be?
I had to cut about 25,000 words from the book. So I think it makes the book leaner and more effective. But I would have liked to have done a chapter just on the issue of how to do reparations during conflict. It's something which, you know, is obviously quite relevant to the ongoing issues around the world. But it's something which has its own dynamics. I touched it briefly on chapter 6, but it is something different. You know, Colombia is a good example of trying to do reparations during conflict, but as one civil society actor said to us, you know, they're adding 10,000 victims each month still to the register for people to claim reparations. So how do you sort of turn off the tap of victimization? You know, when does it ever stop? Reparations isn't changing things, and you got people coming back claiming again and again, you know. So I would like to reflect on like how, you know, reparations could be used during conflict. It's maybe sort of a way to think about ending conflict.
What is the reparations case that you consider the most successful?
I get that question a lot. Or, you know, which country, you know, was the most success in terms of percentage? And I think it's very difficult. You know, you can look at Peru, and Peru's completed its reparations program and it delivered it to what, 90-95% of all victims. But the victims, you know, some we talked to weren't all satisfied. It was very small amounts. Where you can look at places like Colombia, where it's delivered reparations to just over about 11% of victims, but it's delivered, you know, to 1.25 million victims. So it's more than the 70,000 in Peru, but it's going to take 75 years to deliver to the other 8 million victims. So I think Colombia has really tried to push the boundaries on it, but it suffered from politicization like every country does, and programs being defunded or not getting sufficient funding. And I think the Truth Commission recently brought out recommendations. I think there was maybe over 1,000 recommendations about how the reparations program could be improved. So I think the thing with reparations is it's an evolving process. It's iterative, you know, and I think victims constantly try to push the program to improve in itself. So it's a way of sort of evolving the system to ensure that that you're always pursuing success. But at the end of the day, you know, victims don't want to be always labeled as victims and having to constantly come back. So you want to try to aim to do the most as you can.
Just listening to you, it occurred to me that very interesting would be if you did you see any kind of countries that looked at other or neighboring countries or other countries in the world for lessons for this improving of reparations programs? Do you have this synergy between countries, or pretty much everybody reinvents the wheel every time they are thinking of reparations?
No, I think there's definitely a bit of shopping about for ideas. So in relation to some of the Latin American countries, there was a lot of experience learned, and there's a lot of back and forth between different countries. You know, so Colombians would talk about how Mexico copied their victims' law, but it's not fit for purpose because, you know, it's a completely different situation. But even in Northern Ireland, like we would always critique that, you know, after our peace agreement, there was a pile of South Africans that came over. And even like in contemporary debates, people would talk about, let's do a South African Truth Commission. And, you know, it's a very sort of minimalistic understanding of what happened and the context of how that's developed and also the problems that came after. So I think people do like the idea of, you know, and how that goes to the issue of vernacular of reparations. They have some sort of concept, and there's almost like a platform of international experts that go around and talk on reparations. Like with Ukraine, there's a whole junket of people, you know, in that area talking about reparations, and you know, you know, where's their baseline understanding? What's their sort of motivation? Because there's a lot of money, you know, floating about. And it was the same thing in Colombia. You had a lot of experts being brought in to help shape different things. And, you know, you have to also weigh it up against local expertise and local experience. How do you find the best balance between that? Because in Nepal, you had a law which was very heavily international NGO focused, but it also then sort of stymied issues around truth recovery, it also created a reparations term, which sort of, you know, involved notions of caste. So there's a key role for trying to get a balance between, you know, international expertise and comparative, you know, experience, to also trying to design things with that knowledge.
Because you mentioned Ukraine, there has been a lot of talk on reparations being offered once the war in Ukraine is over. Could you briefly explain to our listeners the usefulness of reparations for that particular situation and its feasibility? How do you see reparations related to the ongoing war in Ukraine?
Yeah, so I'm constantly invited to sort of different the groups to speak on this issue. Some to NGOs, some to victims groups, some to international organizations. So there's a lot of it. Like, I've never seen so much attention for reparations. It's good, but also I see it at the sort of the international level. The debate on reparations is getting absorbed by reconstruction. And so there is a lot of interest in how international funding is going to reconstruct Ukraine, because there's been so much devastation of infrastructure and urban centers. I think what's important with reparations is that it's trying to alleviate victims' harm. And, you know, something which we talk about in our project's final output, the Belfast Guidelines on Reparations, is that you need to implement reparations as soon as possible, because the victims' harm only gets worse. Their health deteriorates, you know, it can be more difficult to trace them, more difficult for them to get evidence. And so in the case of Ukraine, we should be aiming to set up some sort of program that helps and gives specialists, you know, healthcare or resources to victims as soon as possible.
But I think, who would offer these reparations? Is the Ukrainian government, the international community? Because I'm not sure that the Russian government will be so forthcoming.
Yeah, no, I would say that the Ukrainian government has obligations to ensure that every person within its jurisdiction has access to an effective remedy and reparation. So even though Ukraine isn't responsible, it's responsible for looking after its own people or people within its jurisdiction. Now, really, when it comes to the war itself, Russia is responsible for causing this war of aggression and for committing horrendous war crimes, you know, and also potentially crimes against humanity. But we can't wait until there's going to be a peace settlement. There is a lot of efforts, you know, with the register of damage, which has been created to collect claims, which is going to go operational in the next few months, as well as, you know, assets being seized. There's talk about, you know, $600 billion worth of Russian assets being frozen. Now, the difficulty is you can't, in international law, just take us money and just give it to Ukrainians, because other countries around the world could seize the US, the UK's, or whoever's assets and do the same. It's illegal. But there, I think there's probably a moment where, getting towards the end of the conflict, Russia could be forced to make a contribution to reparations. And we're talking in, you know, billions. You know, it won't be probably 600 or a trillion that's maybe been looked for in terms of the total damage, but I think there probably needs to be about 100 billion, maybe 200 billion set aside for reparations. Now, reconstruction is separate from that, but given the scale, like even the environmental damage, the contamination of land through landmines and cluster munitions, to even like from the few victims I've spoken to, like it's a horrendous even place which are liberated, like Bucha, where people had, you know, their houses used as torture sites, where they saw family members killed in the street. Like, they may never be able to return to those places, and like the psychological harm alone needs to be proper specialist rehabilitation services. Probably the most closest example to what's happening in Ukraine is Colombia, where you have, you know, 9 million victims, a fifth of the population, but in Ukraine you have potentially 14, 15 million victims if you include all refugees and displaced persons. A difficult moment will happen where you'll have to prioritize those who have been killed, suffered sexual violence, been tortured, to ensure that they get redress. So I think it's going to be a very difficult effort, but it's not impossible. The UN Claims Commission that was set up for Iraq dealt with, over 1.5 million victims and you know, gave out over $52 billion. So we have the practice and experience, and we can do this. One of the things we always found that for people who were responsible for violations or for states, they always said there's no money, there's never any money. It's all by political will. If there's a will, we can find a way, and reparations don't have to be paid out all at once. This is going to something that's going to take decades in Ukraine, you know, 30 to maybe 50 years, because that has to follow the life of those victims, and, you know, whether it's through pensions, specialist healthcare, and things like that. So it will have to be an extensive, well thought out effort.
And my last question is, what is your next project? Will you continue to work on reparations, or you move your attention to something else? You just said that you are invited to talk about reparations related to Ukraine. Would that be another book?
I don't know. I think after finishing this book, like pretty much the first half of 2023, I was just drained mentally. So I was just doing like sort of things which like ticked over. And I wasn't anything sort of substantive research wise. I did a report on people who were killed during the Troubles, but it was archival work and the extent to which they were compensated. So that was sort of my transition project. I'm still like very passionate about reparations, and I will do more work, but I'll probably look at it more in terms of how do you deal with an ongoing conflict, what place does that sit, and also how do we better improve the rules of the laws of war, you know, IHL, because there's a fundamental gap there that human rights law doesn't capture. So that's probably where I'm moving. Ultimately, you know, I'll be doing more work in Ukraine, more work in Northern Ireland, so we'll see where things go.
Our guest today at New Books Network was Luke Moffat, a professor of human rights and international humanitarian law in the School of Law of Queen's University in Belfast, and a fellow of the Center George J. Mitchell Institute for Global Peace, Security and Justice at the same university. He talked to us so eloquently and passionately about his latest book, Reparations and War, Finding Balance in Repairing the Past, which was just published with Oxford University Press earlier this year. Thank you very much, and hope we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.